This podcast is brought to you by Vivino. Discover and buy wines wherever you are. Visit vivino.com/heritage to stock up.
Hi, I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week's theme is youth. We'll have a report on how migrant children separated from their families at the U.S. border are being housed and fed.
Right now, what we're very worried about is just the influx of kids created by this zero tolerance policy.
We'll also look into a program that's ensuring free summer meals for kids are only a text message away.
Summer is the hungriest time of year for a kid who may not have that safety net of school meals.
We discover a new home economics curriculum.
I'm not trying to raise a generation of chefs. I'm trying to raise a generation of nourishers who can nourish themselves.
And we meet a teen chef who's talked his way into several of New York's top kitchens.
I never try and be, like, annoying about it, but I really want to get my foot in the door.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three, available at heritageradionetwork.org and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, and welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Here today with Ned Baldwin, a fisherman, sculptor, chef, artist, philosopher. You wear many hats in the kitchen and outside. But it's this restaurant that you have in an odd little neighborhood of Lower Manhattan that I think encompasses all the things that you've ever done in your life and the humility therewith. So let's first start in the Pacific Northwest, the son and grandson of a fisherman, and why the sea has your heart.
Well, I grew up in Seattle, and I don't know. It's probably happier just born that way. You just like the water. Some people do, some people don't. I'm happier in it probably than I am when I'm not in it. But in Seattle, you know, you just can't go anywhere without seeing or being near or having to contend with it because there are lakes and canals and you know, Puget Sound. It's everywhere. And you know, if you leave the city, the likelihood you're going to get on a ferry to go somewhere is pretty high. My dad had a sailboat, so you know, I was apparently strapped to a something in a bassinet when I was, you know, weeks old going to Canada. Maybe those things set in early. I don't know.
Yeah, I've been to Seattle and the thriving areas of like Ballard and, you know, which were all old Norwegian fishermen areas of the city. And some restaurants have reclaimed buildings, reclaimed some kind of zeitgeist of that era and made it into seafood forward restaurants.
Yeah. I mean, the ingredients out there are bonkers. Really, really great. Not limited to the seafood. I mean, the vegetables are amazing. The growing season's longer than here. Doesn't get as cold in the winter. Although one of my close friends has a farm and they definitely contend with water out there. He's dealing with floods all the time in his fields.
Aside from the flooding, it seems so idyllic. Why would you ever relocate to the Northeast?
Oh, well, art school. I ended up going to Yale for grad school and so spent 2 years in New Haven studying sculpture. And I didn't know this while I was in school. They try to tell me that you know, getting an MFA, it's like going to trade school. Like, it's about making connections and starting your career as an artist. I'm very idealistic and too old to be that way, but I thought it was just about getting, you know, learning about who I was, an artist or whatever. But in any case, by the time it ended, I had relationships, or at least I knew a whole mountain of art people in the Northeast, and it seemed ridiculous not to stay here. So I moved into the city and got a studio in the Bronx, and
we have to give a little shout out to Bennington, though, because I know you went there initially for art and philosophy, and yeah. My wife and many people we know went there as well. But what it does is inform the person you are and the way you kind of move around the world. And I'm assuming Yale did the same thing, that you want to make the art you want to make, or you want to be the person you want to be without compromise.
Yeah, that's true, actually. And Bennington, there's a great little Bennington story. I actually went to a school called Whitman for 2 years in Walla Walla, Washington, where they're producing spectacular wine now. But at the end of the day, I kind of found the school a little provincial, and I think I wanted to get out of Washington State, so I took a year off and transferred to Bennington. But in the process of transferring, before I chose Bennington, I set up these. I knew I was going to study philosophy, and I had been super interested in ceramics from high school, and ended up spending the year off doing that. And so then wanted to keep doing it, but I had these, you know, I was 19 or 20 years old, very idealistic ideas about, you know, that you can't make ceramics on a semester system. It's not the right way to learn it. This time and like the academic environment was wrong. And so I needed to find a school that would let me practice, but wouldn't force it into their school system. And so I went to Sarah Lawrence, and I went to Hampshire, and I went to Alfred, visited all these schools, and asked them, like, can I study philosophy and just work in your ceramic studio? And all of them said no. And then I went to Bennington, and Barry Bartlett, who remains a friend and who I love, and I'm not going to say he's a great artist, but I love his work, was like, sure, you know, come on in. And, you know, I wasn't bad at it by then. I could handle the clay pretty well. And, he saw me working, and I think he was like, oh, you know, whatever. And then, of course, I immediately just started taking classes when I got there.
Was it with intent of it being art or it being functional, the sculpture or the ceramics?
Yeah, I was making pots. I like learning how to do stuff. This is ridiculous, but I was like an obsessive windsurfer when I was in middle school and high school. And, you know, it's about mastery. Like, not that I ever end up mastering anything, but, you know, the idea of it or the challenge of it. So, you know, making pots is about, you know, windsurfing is such a random example, but.
I think it is the first time windsurfing has been mentioned on the food scene.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. So, you know, like making a perfect, you know, having a perfect run, you know, with the wind blowing right and everything's all lined up and everything's great, like tying that down, and you just do it over and over and over and over again. Same story in ceramics. You make the bowl over and over and over and over again. And, you know, I could list 14 other things in between that and making an omelet at Prune on Saturday and Sunday morning over and over and over and over again. You know, it's just repetition until you get it.
This studio that you got in the Bronx and came to New York to be an artist, why did you end up making furniture instead?
Because, I quit making clay stuff partly because I didn't know at the time, but I got... have a autoimmune thing that's arthritis, and my back was really bugging me. Clay's really heavy, and at a certain point I stopped making practical things and started making impractical things out of clay. There's all this sort of heroic clay stuff. I don't care one way or another about that, but it gets heavy when it's even not very big, so I wanted to have a freedom to make whatever scale of thing I wanted. So I quit making clay stuff and I started making it out of other things. And then I realized that I needed, probably not everybody would think this way, but I've found myself frustrated by my lack of facility with other materials, and that ended up kind of leading me into carpentry. And so I somehow got back. I spent a year in Omaha. That was where that transition happened. At a artist residency program called the Bemis. It's a cool place and weird and very, very far from water, which ultimately was why I think I had to go. So I went back to Seattle, and I, through an old family friend, met this guy, fascinating guy, who went to MIT, studied electrical engineering, got out of school, and was like, I really need to know how to build a house. As soon as he got out of undergrad, that's what he wanted to do. Met some family in New Hampshire that built houses from dig the hole, pour the concrete, all the way through to make the windows, lay the roof, do the wiring, the plant. They did everything. And he learned everything, the whole damn thing. Like, he was a full 360-degree builder. He was 50 when I met him. So he's living in Seattle. He's actually living in this awesome little town called LeConnor on the water. And living in whatever house he was working on. So he and I started a little business. We bought houses and renovated them. And I did that in part because I knew I could learn how to make anything. working with him. So we spent like 3 years doing that.
This seems like a very similar, a parallel story to building a houseman. Not to lift that term from you, but it was at the age of 35 that you decided you wanted to cook.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's no way to do that in New York without starting from the bottom up.
That's very true. That's very true.
But where did that change from flipping houses to flipping omelets?
Well, there was art school in between. It seems like I go in and out of practical and impractical. Like, I get to a point where I'm like, Jesus, this is way too rational. You know, like the house project started to be, I started having to make decisions that I hated. I won't go into it, but I started making bad decisions in the house business because the art part was coming on.
So, you always got to ward away the art part.
Well, or bring it in because, you know, I quit doing the houses and went to art school. So, you know, then I guess I was living in New York and I'm not that good at the hustle. And art in New York, there's a lot of hustle. You can make the work, but, you know, it's everything in New York boils down to real estate. And, you know, so if you make like 5 sculptures, where the hell are you going to put them if you don't sell them or get them in a show or whatever? They start to pile up in the studio. And so I'm absolutely not going to say anything about whether or not my work was any good. I don't know and I don't care, but I wasn't good at selling it. I wasn't good at getting it out there. And so, gradually, And combine that with, I just love to work. Like I find it very calming when there's sort of like an insurmountable mountain of work in front of me, unclimbable mountain. So cooking is that, you know. And I learned that because a friend of mine, while I was still making art, I became friends with a guy who was a chef he was a cook at Ducasse at the Essex House, Ducasse's first restaurant in New York. And he somehow, Christian Duluvrier was the chef at the time, and he somehow got me invited to come in there for a week and stand around and watch and peel salsa feet and whatever. My mind was blown. And it was like getting a taste of any of these things. Like, oh my God, I want to learn this thing. I wonder if I can do this thing. And so, you know, I did that. He actually set me up with another trail a year later at John George. And then I set myself up with a trail a year later at Prune. And so it was like a gradual extraction. And all the while, I'm reading everything I get my hands on about food and cooking at home every day, you know. And dinner, you know, I'll be in the studio. And if I had had a boss in the studio, I would have gotten fired in a minute. You know, because I'm like, you know, trying to make stuff. And in the meantime, like thinking like squab and, you know, salad this and how am I going to terrine that and consomme, all the classic stupid stuff, you know, wanting to learn how to do it and, you know, going home and making it for friends. So eventually, Andy Nusser, actually, I have 2 kids. They're 13 and 11 now. And the 11-year-old had been born a month before in kind of a blaze of glory. It was terrifying at the time, not because of every birth was terrifying, but because hers was in particular. And she was still in the hospital. My wife was not well. And I was taking my son to school, and his school was right down the street from Casamono. And I saw that Andy was in there cooking lunch. And from where I sit now, I realized probably he had a cook sick or quit or had to fire him. He wouldn't normally have been cooking lunch, but there he was. And there was no one in there. So I dropped my son off for school, nursery school, and went back and sat at the bar. And he had just been in Spain and he had all this stuff. And, you know, we chatted and I didn't really let on that I knew anything about who he was or whatever till, you know, 1 or 2 glasses of cava in. And I mean, I think I ate the whole menu. It was awesome. And then I guess I told him about this trailing that I just mentioned here. And he was like, oh, you should come work here. And so I did. And the second day, I remember very specifically, I was cleaning fiddlehead ferns. And he came in and was like, are you interested in charcuterie? Do you want to go learn this? And, you know, there's this place. And he knew I had kids and I couldn't really take on a crazy nighttime cook schedule quite yet. Need to be broken into that a little bit. And so Liz Benno was at Italian Wine Merchants just down the street. And he's like, go over there right now. And like, I'm like, well, I'm not done with the ferns.
Get out of my kitchen. You're doing a terrible job. Go play with some meat.
Yeah, exactly. So I went over there and that was it. I got, you know, she offered me a job. I probably started 2 weeks later and, you know, had to break down the studio and, you know, months in. And so that, I guess that was the beginning. That was the beginning of the end.
So we're going to take a quick break on that. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. We'll be right back.
You're visiting the in-laws this weekend. They've asked you to bring wine. You need a bottle that says, I'm laid back enough that I didn't think about this choice for hours. But also, I've graduated from Two Buck Chuck, proving I can provide for your daughter and our future children. Where to go from here? Just ask Vivino. Vivino knows feeling pressured in the wine aisle can sour the whole experience. But with the largest wine inventory, Vivino gives you the best price on personalized picks based on your taste profile, then ships them right to your door. Scan wines, compare reviews, save your favorites, and even get unlimited free shipping with Vivino Premium, plus a free 30-day trial. So, when that next visit rolls around, you know exactly what that dry Alsatian Riesling says about your commitment to your mother-in-law's Sunday roast. Visit vivino.com/heritage to stock up. Vivino. Wine made easy.
Hi, I'm Moxie Rosenblum. My dad, Harry Rosenblum, hosts Feast Your Ears on Heritage Radio Network. Right now, HRN is having a summer membership drive. Becoming a member is so easy, and you'll help support shows like my dad's. You can sign up for a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Let's keep food radio on the airwaves this summer.
Welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Ned Baldwin of Houseman. And I want to define this word, and I'm going to mispronounce it, and I think you know what word I'm talking about.
Is it Houseman's Coast?
Yes.
Yeah.
What does it mean to you? What does it mean literally?
Well, literally, I guess it translates. I don't speak any Scandinavian languages.
You look Scandinavian.
I'm 25% Swedish.
The beards.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. It means houseman's food. That's the, literal translation of the words. But in Norway, and I also think, I learned the word in Norway, but I think it means the same thing in Denmark and in Sweden. It means like traditional food of the place. So, I learned it traveling around with a Norwegian friend. And he, you know, we'd be eating, his dad was a chef, so we like ate like crazy when we were there. He's as into food as I am. So we'd be eating, I don't even know what, we'd be eating boiled cod, and he'd say, oh, this is really Husmann's Coast. Like, this is real Norwegian food. That was 2003, 2002. So it's the word just sat with me for a long time.
And then 10 years later, you transform that term into what is now Houseman at 508 Greenwich Street in this interesting little area below Spring Street called Hudson Square in Lower Manhattan. And I've been there and I've had most of the menu, and so have many critics. And New York Times' Pete Wells thought the roast chicken was a revelation, and New York Mag has said that you have the best steak frites, one of the best egg sandwiches, Time Out in New York, one of the best grilled cheeses, the French onion soup sandwich. None of that is in practical food. That is very practical food. It is very straightforward, but what do you do to make something appear on a best of list? It's something that people already know and expect. What do you do that's impractical or outside of what they'd expect to make it exemplary?
That's a good question. Maybe the steak's the best place to answer that question. And I like the practical stuff because you can do it. You do it over. We said this already. We do it over and over again. The reason that's fun to do it over and over again is you learn. If you're paying attention, if you continue to pay attention on the 100th time or the 500th time, you learn something you didn't know on the 50th time. So, common wisdom with steak cooking is you get a pan hot or you get the grill hot and you salt the meat and you put it in and you sear the steak. And there's this, you know, this sort of fantasy notion of searing the juices in. I don't know what the hell that means. so we're cooking the steak, and I started to notice when I ate pieces of it that I didn't like the crunchy part that much. And I also noticed that the harder you sear the steak, we do it with a hanger steak, the harder you sear the steak, the further into the radius of the steak the hard cook goes. So, you know, the perfect steak you want, whether it's a medium well steak or a rare steak, you want it, the ideal is that it looks the same from the middle all the way to the edge. So when you put that hard sear on it, two things. I don't want the crunch, and I was working against the goal of a perfect coast-to-coast cook. So I didn't know that on the 50th one, but I'm really started to pick it up on, I don't know how many we've cooked now, so many. So we now sear that steak to gray with blushes of mahogany, just barely. It's super fun teaching cooks how to do it. They can't. They just can't. Like, you tell them to do it, and they don't. For, like, the first week on a station, they'll fuck it up one after the other, and I'm yelling at them. There's smoke coming out. I'm not yelling, but I'm, there's smoke coming out of the pan, and, you know, it's, like, not good. But they can't. It's just, like, they've been taught their whole life. So then the hanger steak is, I mean, because it eats the hanger, he eats so well raw. It's so delicious. The mouth feels incredible. The flavor's incredible. So, you know, you don't want to do anything to get in the way of that. It's a long-winded answer, but I think it's paying attention. What it is.
And I'm not going to, you know, not repeat this quote that you have for yourself, a perfect coast-to-coast cook. And that was about the gradation of the steak. But that brings me back to your Pacific Northwest and now Northeast, mm-hmm. and that steak frites, egg sandwiches, grilled cheeses, roast chickens. Yes, this is everyday food, but is it everyday local food to here? What is on your menu and why?
Oh, well, I mean, it's 2018. We start with the ingredients. And we love to cook. So the restaurant's a couple of things. The restaurant is, because it's in this neighborhood, and because I like to stay in business, I don't seem to be super motivated to do much more than just stay in business, but we got to keep the doors open to keep cooking. And so we have to have people coming in and eating every day, and we have to be a neighborhood restaurant, in short. So we have to be a bit of a bistro, I think, to succeed in this neighborhood. And an American bistro, which is another way of saying a Hoosman's Ghost, has to do a few things. It has to have a burger. It has to have a roast chicken. It has to have a good salad. And as it turns out, sort of has to have a good steak. They buy the steak like crazy. So I give them that stuff. And then that frees me up to do whatever I want, basically, with the rest of the menu. So it's a bit of a, it's a give and take. So the rest of the menu, I do whatever I want. I love cooking bluefish. I like to eat local conch. We get whole animals in. I like to do whatever the hell I want with those, to cook the kidneys and the liver. And I mean, that's the most fun thing. Like, you get the animal and it's nothing new in New York at this point. Everybody's buying, or all the groovy restaurants are buying animals and doing, the stuff with them. But I absolutely love that you get two orders of kidneys out of, one animal, and you can sell this special thing, when you have it.
Fish too.
Yeah.
You are the son and grandson of a fisherman, but you are your own kind of fish advocate by using local fish, maybe some of the unsexier, unknown fish, and putting them on your menu. I've seen bluefish be very polarizing, mm-hmm. yet it is so authentically of this area,
yeah.
of Long Island, and I think it's delicious. It's one of these, you got to get it fresh, otherwise people have a bad, it's not the best when it's not coming right out of the water.
It deteriorates quickly.
Yeah, it's so oily, but at the same time, that kind of flesh is so good when it's braised and in papillon.
Yeah, or just cooked the way you cook striped bass.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't matter. When you get it, as long as it's right out of the water, it's fine. And then there are a lot of things you can do. You know, like we, in the restaurant, more than anything, we do a pickle on it. I just noticed that I was doing Spanish mackerel at another restaurant pickling and couldn't get it and thought, oh, maybe bluefish. And it pickles great. Really, really nice. So we do that more than anything. And you know, as far as the, you know, like if it's not 1 minute out of the sea or it's not, it doesn't have to be 1 minute out of the sea. There's so, I could talk about bluefish for a really long time.
We got some time.
Okay.
That and local cod too, because one of your dishes, I don't know if it's on the menu at the moment, is a poached local cod. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a very interesting thing. You know, I cooked in New England for years to see cod be poached.
Uh-huh. Well, that's straight Norway. And that's my friend, that's Frank, who you know, we were in northern Norway. And he said, let's go get some cod. And we got in a rowboat and dropped this line to the bottom that was like, you know, 800-pound test mono and with these rusty hooks with a crappy piece of rubber on the end. And you literally drop them to the bottom, boom, 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 boom. And they're like five hooks on each line. And you pull up and it's full cod. I mean, just like practically reaching in the water and taking them out of the water with your hand. And then we row back, clean the fish. And then he gets a pot and walks down the sea and fills it with seawater and plunks the pot on the stove and boils the cod. I can't not say it the way he always says boils. You imagine boil means, and he kept saying it, and I kept imagining the water boiling. Of course, he's a good cook. It's not boiling. It's you know, it's not even simmering. It's just warm water that the cod's cooking in and warm seawater. So great. So, I mean, that experience indelibly printed on my mind. I can't ever forget that. And I love it. And there's something so, I love the putting all the stuff in the same place, you know, so the cod's cooking in the water that it's swimming in. And Frankie didn't do this. He served it with potatoes, boiled potatoes that he boiled in seawater that had a little bit of poaching liquid in them and butter and parsley. Just that. So, I mean, like revelatory, so perfect and delicious and right of, you know, you're right in the place. That's the thing. I love that. I love when food does that. Like just plunks you right exactly where you are.
So what is your fishing place? I know the North Fork isn't too far.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was on the water yesterday. So the place changes a little bit depending on the season. Right now it was a very cold spring. So the fish are still in the shallow water. So I was kind of in the bays, I guess, in between the North Fork and the South Fork. It has just gotten warm, and I don't know nothing from nothing about this stuff. But my mind does stuff while I'm fishing, you know. So it seems like maybe the cold spring, you know, normally like the porgies come, and I love porgies, love mm-hmm. catching them, love cooking them. And then the weak fish come, and then, you know, the black sea bass around, but you can't catch them because they're not in season. The bluefish come, the striped bass. I didn't know this till this year, that the bluefish usually come after the striped bass. But in any case, it seems as if they, this year, have all arrived en masse at the same time. And you can go anywhere you want out there, and the fish are just leaping out of the sea. It's crazy.
It's New Yorkers when it gets warm out after a long winter. Yeah, right. They all just come out of the woodworks and they just all co-mingle and they're fine with each other
for a minute.
Yeah. And then summer hits and it's all over.
Yeah.
But so what of those fish do you not see in restaurants enough? Should people be eating
it? That's a great question.
How should they be eating it?
Yeah. Well, that's an opportunity for a plug for a book called The Fisherman's Wife that I didn't write. It's by Stephanie Villani, who owns Blue Moon Fish. And so she and her husband are commercial fishermen that fish in the Sound, on the Sound side, out of Matituck. And, the book is all about using all the fish. I think she gets tired of answering questions about how to cook striped bass, which is the fish everybody thinks they should be cooking, or black sea bass. So it's just full of recipes for that, all different kinds of fish. But for me, I'll take every opportunity to cook all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, I just learned last year that dogfish is delicious. Some people call it sand shark, poached, preserved. I mean, I haven't plumbed all the ways yet. I'm looking forward to continuing to goof around with it. Sea robin, is very delicious. And there's a fun fact about sea robin. It's in French, it's called rascasse. And every classic text there is about bouillabaisse makes it very clear that if you don't have rascasse in there, it's not bouillabaisse. And this is a fish that's, I mean, I couldn't get them off the hook this weekend. They're everywhere. And everyone who can, I mean, you can hear the other boats, goddamn sea robins, birds on my hook, complaining about it. And same with dogfish. You know, these are delicious, plentiful fish that people are angry about catching and throwing back in the water. It's very funny.
Let's plug another book. Right now, it exists on Instagram at Ned and Pete Cook Dinner. And that Pete is Peter Kaminsky. Mm-hmm. And there was this felicitous meeting, or maybe not even a meeting. You knew he was coming into your restaurant. Mm-hmm. You served him a big fish. He is a fisherman, as are you. And you guys are writing a book about...
Not about fishing.
Yeah.
To the best of our ability. Yeah. We're writing a cookbook. So it's about how to cook stuff. We've been talking about learning how to do stuff, whether it's learning how to make carpentry, build houses or, make pots or cook omelets. What we found through a lot of talking, because when he came in the restaurant, we hit it off. Found you, and if you're going to make a cookbook with somebody, you're going to spend an insane amount of time together. So it's important that you enjoy each other's company and get along, and your minds kind of work at a similar frequency. And we found that ours do, which is an incredible gift for me, because I have always, it's like one of the cool things about having a restaurant. And not going out of business too quickly is, in New York anyway, I'm finding I get to meet a lot of heroes. It's really, really cool. We discovered that this process I have of figure out how to make this thing. So figure out how to make that roast chicken or figure out how to make that steak. There's a process that has some ins and outs, not complicated, but some particulars. And then you kind of get the process, and then you do a bunch of things with it. So, we always have roast chicken on the menu at Houseman. We serve it maybe 8 or 12 different ways over the course of a year. So the book is founded on, actually with the chicken as a prototype, it's founded on that concept. Here's how you make a delicious roast chicken at home simply. And then here are 5 ways to serve it. So we do that 25 times in the book with 25 different sort of, we're right now, it's not a very sexy way of saying it, but we're calling them base ingredients or base processes. And then, 5 recipes around each one of those.
That seems like what you've done with your whole life.
Yeah.
And on that, if people don't want to do their own chicken at home, they can come into Houseman and see you, because it will always be there.
It will always be there.
But Ned, thank you so much. Thank you for making Houseman. And I hope to revisit and have some bluefish soon.
Yeah, great. Pleasure's all mine. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Music by Cookies and David Tadashore Engineering. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.